You're listening to ABC Radio National, Amanda Smith with you with Artworks and part six of The Art of Being Europe. This is the feature series produced and presented by Lynn Gallagher, our winner of the European Union Journalism Award. Now, what would make you get out into the streets with thousands of other people and hold hands and sing? In Estonia, it happened at a critical moment in their recent political history. And you'll hear more about this in this final program in the series, this episode, A Soul for Europe. Lynn Gallagher begins in the snow in Finland, about an hour out of Helsinki.
Like that.
This shop is in a small village called Fiskars. It's the same Fiskars that makes scissors, knives and garden tools. But here in Finland's oldest industrial village, the empty workers' huts have been taken over by artists, and it's now a centre for the very best Finnish art, craft and design.
Our success is that we have jewellery, ceramics, candles, soap, textile, glass, wood, everything.
As a ceramist, I do many different styles, and 2006, when we had Remix, my recycled exhibition, so we rebuild a kiln, wood fire and kiln. So
this is Rita Talonpoika, a ceramic artist and Fiskars board member.
This is made with electricity, and I'm a thrower, so I hand throw everything, and so I have colourful pieces that are hand-painted, also in a unique way, though. And
she convinces me to buy a jug, but there's a problem.
How do you get it home to Australia?
There is bubble wrap and things like that.
There's some.
My jug isn't a big boost to the European economy, but it's an example of a wider trend.
Oh, lovely.
Some snow to take home.
It represents a return to craft, to the hands-on process of creation, which leads to innovation in technique and a pride in the object, and in turn, a pride in the community.
Oh, there you go. Thank you very much.
It's this combination of economics, politics, art and culture that intrigues Nelly Hertling. As well as being the vice president of the Berlin Arts Academy, Nelly is the co-founder of the Soul for Europe movement, which, as she says, is quite a story.
It began around the year 2000 or even a bit earlier. At that time, Berlin really was, in a way, in the center of Europe, with the new, old, new Europe around us. So slowly the idea came up, we should try to follow two ideas, principal ideas, that to develop this new Europe, culture should be integrated into every political decision making, not only for culture, but on every level, as a driving force, as a creative thinking possibility. And the second idea was to do that based on the next, on the young generation, to give a voice and visibility to Europe's young generation. These were the two ideas.
But do you really think soul is the right word?
Yeah, so many people at that time thought it's too romantic, it's too
ooh,
emotional, you shouldn't do that.
That.
I was fighting for it. I must say it was my idea at that time, and I liked it because this was a feeling, for, and I was very much informed about Eastern Europe through all these other projects. So I knew that what was missing was this emotional level for the young people to somehow accept the European idea. So we kept the idea and we kept the word, and now everybody loves it and everybody is using it because it's clear the emotional level was missing in the European debate.
This is the music of Veljo Tormis, one of Estonia's most famous composers. It was song that helped keep the Estonian culture alive during Soviet occupation, so much so it became the focal point of the revolution. Even now, 20 years on, Estonia still has the biggest song celebration in the world. Kay Tanner is the General Secretary of the Estonian Choral Society, and she was there during the Singing Revolution.
I was, of course, a teenager then, and so very very fond of what was happening. Actually, it was two different things. It was so-called Baltic Chain, which was organized in August, and which really was uniting all three Baltic states. And there was so-called Singing Revolution, which were held in the same Song Celebration Square. And it was just organized like night concert of Estonian patriotic songs. And people all went there. And now they say from IRA photos that there was about 300,000 people. And actually it is one third of all nation. So it is a very big percentage. And people went there to sing patriotic songs, which were prohibited. Of course, Soviet police was there observing it, but you can't arrest 300,000 people. You have no place to put them. So it was wonderful feeling that you can feel after so many years that I can sing these songs, I can do it.
The Baltic Chain stretched across Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia. It was a chain made up of people holding hands and singing, and they kept it up for around a week. Estonian theatre director Peter Jakalas was also there.
It's very hard to kind of imagine at the moment to go out and hold hands and sing all together. Usually we don't do this kind of things, but in a critical moment, we are even capable of some romanticism, and that's a very nice thing to know. I feel lucky because I was also in Berlin when the war came down, and so this hope and poetry. What was in this, in those moments. I'm really proud that I could be part of that.
These big emotional moments in a country's history are all about the ideal, the vision, the passion. But what happens when romanticism meets reality? What about the day-to-day collision between mind and matter? It's also a problem that this kind of emotion can be used to foster nationalism and can destroy the idea of Europe rather than sustain it.
The European parliamentarians see the need of all this. They love the idea. They follow us. They support us. But, of course, they can only do what they do based on national consensus. And the national consensus is much harder to get, not only in the East. I mean, France is incredible, Italy is incredible. So you have very similar problems all over. They get more and more conservative and more not just nationalistic, but really going back to very national ideas to overcome all the problems, because the population... Economy is a big problem, and security is a problem, big, big problem nowadays. But being in it for so long, I'm now a bit more, I'm not so radical anymore in this idea of all of them being like that. You find all over. I mean, we found in Bulgaria, a country very difficult, Romania, you find politicians and even administrational people who really want to do something, but they have no... Very often, no financial support from anywhere. They are very poor, so they have to decide very often based on very small budgets and applications from all over to do things. So it's not so easy. I wouldn't say they are, of course, exist. There are many short-sighted just wanting to be elected. But I think it changed over the last 2 or 3 years. So the political situation is changing, on one hand getting more and more conservative, but on the other hand more and more, even in politics, people realizing something else has to be done. So for the last 2 years, it's easier for Europe to get political support than 3 or 4 years before, because this recognition something has been missing is somehow growing.
And it's true, the movement is growing. The EU's Cultural and Creative Industries Directorate has a wider brief than it did before. Now they not only advocate for the cultural agenda, but they've also started using culture to serve other EU policy objectives. The thinking being that culture can be mainlined into all sorts of conversations, economic, political, environmental, and social. After all, isn't it better to share books than bullets? I'm Lynn Gallagher, this is Artworks on ABC Radio National, and today's the last in our 6-part series on the art of being Europe. And even though the idea of a soul for Europe makes sense in Brussels, it doesn't necessarily make sense in Denmark. This diversity is both the strength and the weakness of European unity. Sanne Crawford is the CEO of the Museum of Contemporary Art at Roskilde, and her response to the idea of a European soul is a snort.
You snort. Why?
Well, I think everybody, or not everybody, but at least I think about EU as a huge bureaucracy, and it's very ineffective somehow. I mean, if you, as an institution, you are also, or you are sometimes tempted to apply for EU cultural funding. But it is so complicated that everybody will hesitate. And then it's also so that you have to, you won't get the money before, after the project, which is a huge problem for cultural institutions, because they cannot just go to the bank and make a loan for this next exhibition. So, so people cannot really use it, or it's, at least it's very complicated. So that's just an example of how bureaucracy is kind of making it not possible to do certain things. And I mean, in terms of cultural politics and in terms of culture, the EU as an institution doesn't really play any role. Even though, I mean, Denmark is extremely internationally oriented, and in many ways you can see the different European art scenes as one European art scenes. I guess it, when you travel around, you'll see it's very coherent somehow. If you go, whether you are in Milan or Brussels or Copenhagen, artists are working in the same media, so maybe even with the same subjects and so on. So in that sense, Europe is one. But that's in the art world, maybe. It's not because of the EU, I think, to be frank.
This isn't an uncommon view. Many arts organisations see themselves as part of a common intellectual space, regardless of Europe. But how could a country like Denmark survive China without the EU? Culture might be fine, but what about the economy? What this points to for Bjørn Nørgaard, one of Denmark's leading visual artists, is a new definition of nationalism. And fittingly, I spoke to him about this at Christiansborg Palace in front of the tapestries he designed for the Queen. Do people perceive this as an ode to the end of nationalism?
No, it's not the end of nationalism. It is giving nationalism another value. Okay. Instead of being us against the other, then it is a special way of experiencing the world. I mean, when you come to Denmark, there's no reason for you to go to Denmark if it's the same as Australia. So through this, you can have another view of how is the world become what it has become.
Perhaps I meant the end of Napoleonic nationalism.
Yeah, definitely.
At this moment, Bjorn showed me his wife in one of the tapestries. She's black and holding a cross. It's a reference to one of his artworks where she wandered nude through the stock exchange.
You can see the black female with a cross.
Oh, that's one of your pieces.
Yeah, well, my wife went through the stock exchange.
And she closed down the stock exchange for a day.
Only one day, I'm sorry. but the idea was that instead of capital as a money, as capital for how the world should and the society should develop, art should be the capital.
Okay.
That was the whole idea.
She didn't get in trouble for that, by the way. I didn't hear the end of the story. Walking naked through the stock exchange, did she get...
Well, we had a cab waiting outside and then we went home. Nobody knew who has done it. It was discussed more days after.
In a way, this isn't dissimilar to Nellie Hertling's Soul for Europe. Perhaps she wouldn't advocate a naked walk through a stock exchange. Her methods are less confrontational. But nevertheless, the connections she's seeking to make between art, the economy and politics are the same as Bjorn Norgaard's. One of her success stories is from Belgrade, at a time when Serbian young people couldn't get visas to travel outside the country.
These younger people, around 30, 35, not so young, they had developed some ideas how to really cope with the situation in Serbia and becoming more European. But their own government didn't care for them. They said, you are young, who are you? You are not important, so we don't want any contact. So they came to the initiative and asked us if we could bring two or three highly visible, important European politicians to a meeting in Belgrade and set up something we then called a forum. So we got, I think, two commissioners and three or four parliamentarians, European parliamentarians, to travel with us to Belgrade. We set up a big, they set up a big conference, and of course, with these European politicians present, they had to come. So this was a very interesting, moving event. There were about, I would say, 200, 250 younger people, mostly students, and 99% had never been outside Serbia because of the visa problem. And many of them, most of them, had never had the chance to talk to a living politician that was not a devil, as they thought, because they were still very much in the old way of thinking. This changed the situation in Belgrade incredibly, because after that, government suddenly invited this small group and said, let's work together on the development of Belgrade, of culture, and on our European acceptance. So this is more or less, in principle, the idea.
The Soul for Europe initiative is a light upon the hill. It aims to be a way of sustaining the conversation between the government and the governed, using culture and intellect as a weapon against self-interest. The Australian ambassador to the EU is Brendan Nelson, and unlike Nellie Hertling, his experience is that this vision is sustained by the memory of war. The problem is, though, that the next generation doesn't have that memory, and so doesn't share that reason for the idealism.
Whilst it's easy at times, I think, to be dismissive of the idealism behind the European Union project, I have had the privilege to be Australia's ambassador here in Belgium for 10 months. On 12 occasions, I have laid a wreath at the Menin Gate. There are 6,167 Australian names on that gate whose bodies were never recovered, having been killed in World War I, and another 6,000 Australians buried with a headstone. So whilst it is easy for any of us, including myself, to be critical at times about some of the aspects of the European Union and its project, the ideal of seeing that Europe is able to live in peace and harmony and be a coherent voice for the principles and philosophy upon which our own country has been built is always worth supporting. And we shouldn't ever forget those things in the past which led to it. Of course, two major conflicts in World War II. And yes, it's messy. Yes, it's untidy. Yes, you'll continue to read and hear stories in Australia about the latest crisis gripping the European Union. But if you just have a look at what they did with Iranian sanctions, in the space of a month, 27 countries agreed to implement not only the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1929, they also adopted additional sanctions, and they did so coherently and effectively. And they've now given powers to the Parliament which are directly already affecting Australia's interests. And as far as we are concerned, it is absolutely essential that we engage Europe, from which we have received, as I say, our political and philosophical legacy.
Meeting Brendan Nelson reminds me it's almost time to head home. And I do so feeling I've learned a lot. The level of debate has been inspiring, and I can't say I've found the soul of Europe, but I found a lot of passionate, engaged, intelligent artists and policymakers who are creating a better Europe through culture. One of the biggest projects that's still on the go is the rebuilding of Berlin's Museum Island, and that's where my tour ends. Here, I'm just one of many tourists who can't fit their coat in the cloakroom.
Well, we are right now in the heart of the museum's island, in the Pergamon Museum, which is the youngest of the five historical buildings on the museum's island. The first one had been built in 1830, and the Pergamon Museum, being the last one, has been opened in 1930. So within the span of 100 years, they had been constructed. And of course, they have suffered during the Second World War, partially very severely suffered, and after the reunification only, the serious reconstruction work and the modernization work has started. Three of the five historical buildings have already been completed in terms of restructuring: the Old National Gallery, the Bode Museum, and the Neues Museum. The Pergamon Museum, being the biggest one, is still waiting for reconstruction. It will start in 2013 and will last 12 years until 2025, and only then the rebuilding and the restructuring and the modernization of the whole complex can be regarded as accomplished.
Last thing has come in, I will close. What is your function?
Okay, thanks. So, well, one of the disadvantages nowadays is that you enter the museum and you come immediately to our highlight. In the future, we try to make it more dramatically. We will have this fourth wing, just have trying to explain.
It's easy to say that Europe's old and tired, but here in the middle of Berlin's Museum Island, there's a buzz. You can feel not only a commitment to rebuilding this Pergamon Museum, but also a commitment to rebuilding Europe's future. This is the light upon the hill.
So, this is a three-wing building, the Pergamon Museum, and now you enter here by the central court. I have this 1980s entrance building, and then you have those narrow doors, and the first thing you see is the Pergamon altar, which is not very very wise in terms of, let's say, growing
downhill
interest and
yeah.
So on. So, in the future, there will be a fourth wing, which was planned actually already by the architects of the original building, but never was completed. And the plans for the future foresee that there will be this fourth wing here, and that the kind of main entrance will be here. And then you will have a continuous walk starting in the south wing with the entrance here.
At the Pergamon Museum in Berlin on Museum Island, a massive reconstruction and restoration project of cultural institutions built in the 19th century, damaged by war and politics in the 20th century, and now one of the symbols for Europe's 21st century. And that brings to an end Lynn Gallagher's series, The Art of Being Europe. The place to go if you want to catch up on any episodes in the series that you've missed is the Artworks website. There's also a fantastic collection there of photographs and videos, as well as transcripts from this marvellous series. I'm Amanda Smith. This is ABC Radio National.